Thank you for listening to the Adventures in Oz podcast, episode 1, Oz Dark and Terrible. I'm Doug, designer and publisher of Adventures in Oz Fantasy Role-Playing Beyond the Yellow Brick Road. No co-host or panel of experts on this one, so I'll try to be as entertaining as possible on my own. For my first episode, I'm reviewing Oz Dark and Terrible, a newly released RPG from a company called Emerald City Expeditions. While it may seem odd that I'm reviewing what could be viewed as a competing product, the fact that I also blog about Oz and gaming makes me almost uniquely qualified. First impressions? The cover design compares itself fairly readily to a White Wolf supplement. The central illustration, featuring interesting takes on three classic Oz characters, walking down the yellow brick road toward the Emerald City. Interestingly enough, there are four silhouettes, though only three characters are shown. It's likely an attempt to get the reader thinking either, insert yourself here, or, where's Dorothy? Because Dorothy does not make an appearance in the book at all. Like a White Wolf supplement, this image fades to a border, a green cloud pattern. I wasn't sure if they were going for a green miasma or out-of-focus overgrown foliage. After reading the book, I'm still not quite sure. The interior of the book is black and white, with the left border of the left-hand page featuring a small woody tree, and the right border of the right-hand page featuring a design of interlocking gears. I'm guessing this is intended to highlight one of the themes of the setting, which is the conflict between magic and technology. Which is a theme I'm kind of sick of, actually. It's overly common and also incredibly difficult to do well. They do make it interesting by personifying those forces in the conflict between the wizard and the witches, but more on that later. The book opens with a small bit of introductory fiction in which a group of gamers at a convention are pulled into this dark and terrible Oz. And for those of you who think that game writers shouldn't touch fiction, this is evidence in your favor. The fact that they're all gamers is trite, and the story plays out like a transcript of a gaming session. The narrator provides only basic details of the setting, and the characters all express themselves via dialogue and practical action. Action that is perhaps a bit too practical in places. One character has a gun, and who brings a gun to a gaming convention, anyway? To fire at enemies, and another character uses martial arts to flip an opponent, then follows it up by stomping his throat in. What martial arts class teaches that? Really? The setting chapter is one of the strongest sections of the book. The primary conceit of the setting is that Dorothy never showed up. All four witches are still alive, and a cold war has evolved between them and the wizard. But that's not the only thing keeping it from being the Oz that we know and love. As the chapter progresses, more and more differences emerge. For example, the gnomish invasion from the story The Emerald City of Oz occurred over 2,000 years ago, and was bloody, violent, and largely successful. It was only defeated by reinforcements sent from the neighboring land of Ev in the form of an army of automatons, including TikTok. Other references are scattered throughout the history of this Oz. It recounts the reign of Blinky as the Witch of the South and Mombi as the Witch of the North, including how she once imprisoned Princess Ozma in a mirror. There are also parallels to Earth history as well. There is an entry similar to the signing of the Magna Carta, but the most obvious references are more modern. In the last 100 years, Oz found itself entangled in two great wars, the last one being ended by the use of a superweapon to decimate two enemy cities. The details of these wars bring up my sole issue with the setting, the idea that science and magic are incompatible in some way. There's only one RPG I'm aware of that incorporated this theme well, and that was Mage the Ascension from White Wolf. Other games have tried, but felt really artificial and arbitrary in their restrictions on one or the other. The restrictions here feel arbitrary as well. The closer to the Emerald City you are, the harder it is to do magic. The farther you are from the Emerald City, the less reliable your technology becomes. They try and pin some of this on the wizard, and how his presence distorts the fabric of reality in a technological direction, but then undermine it by presenting technologists who have been operating in Oz since before his arrival. On top of that, the wizard's technology is powered by a uniquely magical source. Those of you who have read Glinda of Oz might remember the sorceress mineral Gaulau. Well, here it exists as a form of super coal that burns 10 times hotter than normal coal, allowing steam engines to be more practical for a wider variety of applications. It's actually the soot from Gaulau smoke that turned the Emerald City green. Also, for some reason, automatons and the implants from the cybernetic technologists called Vitalists are immune to this technology breakdown. On the one hand, this makes those character types more viable for players who might find their characters wandering all over Oz. On the other hand, it just further blurs the line between technology and magic, even though the idea that they are two different things is one of the cores of the setting. One thing that this setting is not is dark. It is realistic. It is magical, without being overly fantastic. It is a setting that Wicked fans would likely enjoy. The leaders of the five countries are represented as people with understandable goals and motivations. Some of them aren't very nice, but none of them are evil for the sheer sake of being evil. Once we get into the actual rules of the game, my enthusiasm is well and truly crushed. The Balance RPG system, which is the rule set that they use, is heavy with abbreviations and acronyms, many of which are used before they've been properly introduced. The simplest solution would have been placing a glossary of game terms toward the front of the book, but instead it hides in the back where it's not terribly helpful. For those of you willing to slog through it, the system is mostly a mixture of White Wolf's storyteller rules and the D6 system from West End Games, but character creation also includes a point-buy system strongly reminiscent of GURPS from Steve Jackson Games. Dice rolls consist of 10-sided dice equal to relevant traits, like in Storyteller, but they are added, as in the D6 system. There are four races available for play. Anadoms, Animals, Automatons, and Humans. Anadom is short for Animated Dummy. It's what happens when a witch removes the soul of a person and places it in an artificial body. This gives the witch access to both a soulless husk, which has 101 uses in its own right, and a tireless servant. Like all of the other races, there's a light way and a dark way to approach playing an anadom. The ritual that transfers the soul from body to body leaves the memories in the original body, giving many anadoms amnesia. It is possible for an anadom to regain memories of their previous life, but it is not easy. The light way to approach the race is as a character who has no memory and is therefore able to approach the world with a childlike innocence. You can also go dark by giving the character memories of his past life and a desire for vengeance against the witch who stole their body and their life. Or maybe someone abused the childlike innocence of an amnesiac anadom and turned them into a monster without a conscience. Animals are, of course, animals, as described by Maguire in Wicked. Some animals are sentient and capable of language, so they are spelled with capital letters. There is a bestiary chapter toward the end of the book, which details the point costs of the various species of animals for purposes of playing them as characters. The dark option here is a cult called the Uprights. Uprights are carnivorous animals who have the ability to become more human by eating human hearts. The more hearts they eat, the more human their appearance becomes, and the longer they can maintain it. Automatons are beings powered by clockwork, much like TikTok. They're manufactured by technologists, called orologists, and must be wound regularly in order to continue functioning. Their dark option is particularly weak, as the book suggests that some automatons are coldly logical and brutally efficient. The other thing about these races is that their abilities cost a lot of points. The price to play an anadom varies depending on the material used in their construction, but is generally steep. Automatons are too expensive for any but the most high-powered campaigns. And these are races that people are going to want to play. Next up are the six flavors of humans. Outsiders, people from the outside world. Gillikins, who resemble Renaissance-era Europeans. Munchkins, who appear Asian, possibly as a shout-out to the Royal Book of Oz. Quadlings, who are black African tribesmen. And Winkies, who look like Aztecs or Incas or something. And then we have the Ozmites, the inhabitants of the Emerald City, who look like they came from Victorian or Edwardian London. While this does shake up the all-Caucasian all-the-time of the Oz books, it comes with its own problems. By making the culture so exotic, you risk nobody playing them because they're afraid of doing it wrong. And the only time the culture enhances the setting is in the case of the Emerald City. Two other potentially playable races are mentioned in the setting information, but are not presented as playable options. These are the Insectoids, of which the Wogglebug was an example, and the Inan Fin, human-looking fairies who formed the upper classes of Oz before the arrival of the wizard. This would be Princess Ozma. The rules continue to be distracting by presenting themselves in a non-intuitive manner. The combat rules claim to require miniatures, but they're really not necessary. But then, I've run Savage Worlds without minis. Speaking of Savage Worlds, the book even includes Savage Worlds-style blast and cone templates for easy adjudication of area attacks. Overall, it's hard to say that the system supports the setting very well. The setting feels realistic, but additive dice pool systems tend to skew play toward the cinematic. The larger the number of results you can get on the dice, the harder it is to predict or manipulate the results. Though this swinginess can also work against the players, making them feel that they can't trust the dice, and they'll work to avoid rolling dice or accumulate other modifiers to make success more assured, creating a grittier tone. And also, the system seems too cumbersome to simply sit back, producing necessary results quickly and painlessly. The obtuse abbreviations and the need to include two stats with every die roll make it likely that the system is going to intrude every time it is invoked. The Balance RPG system also doesn't have much to support dark gaming. There are rules for psychotrauma, which allows characters to accumulate emotional stress until they snap and go insane, but there are no guidelines for implementing this rule. Specifically, there are no examples for what events cause a given amount of psychotrauma. Players of the World of Darkness games, or Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu, can tell you how much fun and darkness a well-implemented insanity system can add to a game. Destiny points are points that can be spent on saving your bacon in time of need. While systems like this are usually invoked to help bring the awesome into a cinematic game, the fact that you can only carry one destiny point at a time makes it more of a last-ditch option. Also, it suggests that players can cash in half of their character creation capital in order to get one more destiny point, or sell off their sole destiny point in order to build their character on 150% of what they should, which suddenly makes anadoms and automatons more viable at a lower power level, and makes a Dorothy character that much more practical. You know, someone who's not necessarily more powerful or competent than anyone else, but generally luckier. The next two chapters cover the basics of magic and technology in the Land of Oz. Two types of spellcasters and one type of technologist are included. The ones they chose do lay out some very important pieces of the setting, but otherwise it feels like a teaser for an upcoming supplement, which it basically is. The basic magic system is heavily influenced by White Wolf. Magic is divided into spheres, with five elements taken directly from White Wolf's Exalted line. Unless I'm mistaken, the elemental scheme of air, earth, fire, water, and wood do not occur in any pre-existing mythological, philosophical, or alchemical formulary. Spheres of life and mind round out the list. Each of these spheres is purchased as a talent, and the level of talent determines what sort of effects you can do within the sphere, just like in White Wolf's Mage the Awakening. Unlike Mage, however, casters are restricted to predefined spells, at least for now. But the promised supplement will allow players to create their own spells and create improvised effects. The two spellcasters provided are sorcerers and witches. Sorcerers are elementalists with access only to the elemental spheres. Their magic is very in tune with nature and therefore has difficulty affecting anything vaguely technological, refined metals in particular. They get a bonus for one particular elemental sphere and a penalty in one other, each chosen at character creation. They provide energy for their spells by taking fatigue. Witches are not so much a new type of magic user as an upgrade for other spellcasters. By selling your soul to the vaguely defined dark powers, you gain access to even more magical power. You get a familiar, which may or may not try to corrupt you. I mean, it's supposedly sent to you by the dark powers, so you'd think there would be a corruption angle, but the text doesn't mention one. You lose access to one of your elemental spheres, and can never cast spells relating to it again. Additionally, you are now especially vulnerable to exposure from that element, which is why the Wicked Witch of the West goes down to a bucket of water. You gain access to either the life or mind spheres, which were previously unavailable, but whenever you cast a spell, you power it with blood, taking damage. You can also use someone else's blood, but that makes pulling off spells even harder. Neither option feels particularly Aussie. The sorcerer feels generic, and the spells listed are useful, but not evocative. Witches feel more like Halloween witches than Oz witches. But the cardinal witches, the four witches that rule the four quadrants of Oz, have always been witches rather than any other type of caster. Which is weird, because it's implied that the land itself chooses the cardinal witches. Why would it limit its candidate pool to magic users who have already made a pact with dark powers and have a good motivation to perform sacrifices of living creatures? And they really need to get a grip on what a Yukihu is. There are two of them in the stories, so there's at least a little room to make generalizations. They have the ability to change the shape of themselves and others. The way this book talks about Yukihu magic makes me think of Q from Star Trek The Next Generation, not Red Rira or Mrs. Yoop. They only provide one type of technologist to play in the core book, the rest, of course, waiting for the supplement to be released. The Vitalist is important for understanding characters like the Tin Woodman. Vitalists are steampunk cybernetic surgeons, crafting artificial limbs and grafting them onto injured people. In fact, this process has created a whole cadre of Tin Men, a select group of war veterans who continue to serve the wizard in exchange for the replacement limbs that give them a normal life. They've all had their hearts removed to ensure their loyalty, so all you Tin Man fans got a shout-out, too. Technologists can learn schematics, which allow them to make technological devices, and patterns, which allow for smaller, temporary gadgets and effects. Vitalist patterns are based on mesmerism and biofeedback, allowing them to bring certain biological processes under conscious control. Other technologists will probably use patterns to MacGyver up some handy gadget in the nick of time. The equipment chapter is next, and it's an interesting one. For one thing, some items are listed as AdTech, advanced technology that develops difficulties once it's removed from the Emerald City. But they make some rather interesting choices in that regard. A pocket watch can travel anywhere in Oz, but phonographs develop difficulty. Spyglasses, which have remarkably little by way of moving parts, become less reliable the farther you get from the techno-magical glow of the Emerald City. Flintlock rifles work fine no matter where you go, but any other means of producing a spark to ignite gunpowder is somehow reliant on unreasonable technological axioms. It's possible they may have simply picked a year and declared that anything after that point is advanced. While it does mean they don't have to agonize over every single item, it does mean you'll be scratching your head wondering why matches have trouble outside the steampunk glory of the Emerald City. As an ever-so-slightly Baumian footnote, gunpowder grows on trees in Oz, and is harvested much like cinnamon. The other interesting element is the support for all of the weaponry from all of the different cultures in Oz, and they were kind enough to provide illustrations for every item, which is nice, because before this, I had no real idea what an Atl-Atl is, and let me know if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. They strongly recommend restricting cultural weapons and items to those cultures, but to do so feels very artificial. As much as certain cultures may be attached to certain ways of doing things, I don't think they'll turn down something that is demonstrably better, especially when you have the Renaissance European Gillikins sharing a border with the Aztec Winkies. The Winkies are going to have to stay on their toes, because Cortez and his conquistadors are less than a boat ride away this time. The next chapter is titled The Good and the Wicked, and details a number of Oz characters with backgrounds revised to match the changes in the setting. In general, there are two kinds of entries here. The first kind describes a character well integrated into the setting, with a well-thought-out backstory and interesting motivations. The second kind is where the author decided to drag the character through the mud for some sort of juvenile joke. The other problem I have with this section is the lack of ethnic diversity. Not just on the basis of political correctness, but the fact that they created an Oz with these rather prominent ethnic groups. Of all of the characters listed, only four of them are people of color, and one of them is the Shaggy Man, who is depicted as a stereotypical black pimp. Yes, you heard me right. The Shaggy Man is a straight-up pimp. The other three are cardinal witches, though former in one case. Blinky, former Witch of the South, is a black African. The fact that she was defeated and replaced by Glinda, who retains her Gillikin heritage from Wicked, makes this even worse. So the witches of the North and South, whom we've been brought up to think of as the good witches, are white, while the wicked witches of the East and West are not. Queen Anne of Oogaboo is disappointing as well. While Oogaboo is technically in the Winkie country, its people are white, not Indian. On the fold-out map of Oz in the back of the book, nicely done, by the way, it shows an area of disputed territory linking Oogaboo to the Gillikin country. This is particularly notable, as she is the only character presented who is a leader of something smaller than the four countries of Oz, and quite a bit of space is devoted to her very active and very cruel sex life. Which just sets a pattern on how sexuality is portrayed here. Either a character description doesn't mention sex at all, or the character is portrayed as promiscuous. There are no happily married people or really stable relationships. Trot and Captain Bill are the only couple in the book, and the jury's still out on whether this is a May-December romance or some sort of Lolita thing. This Trot is a teenager, so they did manage to dodge the pedophilia bullet. Betsy Bobbin is a bubble-headed cheerleader, and is one of the two characters who have become sex workers in this version of Oz. That said, she's one of the best integrated of the outsider characters. They do need to remember that there's a difference between a mule and a donkey, as they make that mistake often when talking about and illustrating Hank. And Belina's illustration is that of a rooster, not a hen. Scarecrow and Wogglebug both make rather notable appearances, as in, the illustrations that accompany them are notably shocking. The descriptive text notes them both as rather nice guys. They do try to make the Wogglebug dark by making him a vitalist, obsessed with creating new life through science. But there's enough other stuff going on with him that it's hard to picture him as a crazed mad scientist. They do manage to successfully darken a couple of other characters. The Hungry Tiger doesn't have a conscience, so he actually does eat fat babies. Jack Pumpkinhead is good when his head is fresh, but as it goes bad, so does he. Glinda runs the Quadling Country as something between pre-apartheid South Africa and Genua, as described in the Discworld novel Witches Abroad. The China Country is where she puts her criminals, transferring their souls into China dolls and using their husks for manual labor. As I was reading various forum postings about this game, I saw that someone had asked if it could handle Polychrome, the Rainbow's daughter. The response was that she was certainly in the book. And she is, but not as anyone would expect. Rather than try to model her fairy magic, the author simply made her human, the justification being that her father exiled her to Earth in human form as punishment for her wandering nature. And of course, she's the second character presented as a sex worker. So it's kind of a double fail on that one. The most surprising entry in this chapter was the last, Zeb Hugson. I hadn't expected to see him at all. Maybe it was the fact that he only appeared in one book and didn't seem like a very strong character, but here he is. Apparently, without Dorothy and the wizard to help him out, remember that in this version of the setting, Dorothy never came, and therefore the wizard never left, he had to go through that whole harrowing adventure by himself and had a correspondingly harder time of it. The final chapter of the book is a brief bestiary, giving stats for a variety of creatures, both ordinary and Aussie. Kalidas are in here, and the illustration of the hippo giraffe is almost charming. And now that I've reached the end of the book, I have only one question. Where was the Game Master's chapter? For one thing, you can't assume that everyone who picks up your book is an experienced gamer who already knows everything they need to know about running an RPG, especially when you're dealing with an established property like Oz that everyone and their grandmother knows about. And secondly, it's a golden opportunity to tell a prospective GM what you want them to get out of your game. I never got the pervasive feeling of darkness from the book that the promotional material said I should. A well-written 16 pages or so on dark gaming could have turned my opinion completely around. In summary, the setting is realistic, well-written, and engaging. The system is functional, but shows its roots plainly. It's not very dark, but it's not terrible either. Fans of Wicked and Tin Man will probably like it, while Bomb fans will likely be offended by something.